This week on Capitalism, Race and Democracy.
A local AFD party put fake plane tickets into the letterboxes of migrantized workers and families in their area and said, this is your deportation ticket, basically on it. And that's the exact same thing that the Nazis did for the Jewish population. And this is your one-way ticket to Jerusalem.
Researcher and unionist Ellie Koch talks about the recent German elections.
We are a whole different labor movement than what we have today. The militancy that the labor movement had made a whole lot of change for us. I know today you got this administration trying to take that all away from us. And we're going to step back and let that happen.
In Seattle, unionists continue the fight against internal racism.
I mean, she rallied 45,000 women, and women had absolutely no rights. I mean, they were like even more than second-class citizens, you see. So it was extraordinary. I mean, what she did in the Congo was extraordinary.
And we hear about André Blouin, a Congolese political activist, anti-colonial leader, and women's rights advocate. From Pacifica Radio, this is Capitalism, Race, and Democracy, a collective effort by producers from Pacifica stations and affiliates across the U.S. I'm your host, Polina Vasilyev. In Germany's federal elections, the AfD, Alternative for Germany, became the second largest party. Researcher and unionist Ellie Koch talked about the elections with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer.
We're talking now with Ellie Koch. She was a researcher at the University of California at UCLA and now is working in Germany in a trade union and has been following the developments of the right wing and fascism in Germany. Welcome to our show, Ellie.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
So, Ellie, first of all, let's talk about the AfD, which got a very big showing in the election. Where did it come from and why is there a rise of fascism in Germany?
But the AfD party already came about in 2013. Back then, it was just a collection of people who were not content with the government, the economy, all of that. Like a big push back then was the euro and like leaving the euro. You might remember Brexit, something similar for Germany. However, that kind of consolidated until the mid-2010s, I would say, and became more and more right-wing. We already had people in the party like Frauke Petri, who currently is not a member of the party anymore, saying things then like you have to shoot the migrants at the borders to the EU and becoming more and more extreme. And now with a very extreme right-wing caucus within the party taking hold from Thuringia, they have moved more and more towards the right and are spouting fascist rhetoric.
By fascist rhetoric, what do you mean? What are they exactly saying?
I mean, they are using, I mean, it's not just rhetoric. They're using the same tactics that the Nazis used. I think a very interesting example for that is what happened this election cycle when a local AfD party put fake plane tickets into the letterboxes of migrantized workers and families in their area. And said, this is your deportation ticket, basically, on it. And that's the exact same thing that the Nazis did for the Jewish population. And this is your one-way ticket to Jerusalem.
Of course, the rise of immigration to Germany took place because of the United States wars in the Middle East, the bombing of Iraq, mm-hmm. the attack on Libya, the attack on Syria. How many migrants have come to Germany as a result of these U.S. wars in the Middle East?
In 2015, we kind of welcomed a lot of them. Back then, we had, interestingly, a conservative government under Angela Merkel. And she said, oh, we can do this. We can take people in and we can help them. Of course, obfuscating that we are also part of the problem with a kind of imperialist agenda. For instance, the German participation in Afghanistan and other wars. However, this welcoming attitude towards migrants has now completely changed. And interestingly enough, there is a sizable number of people who make the conservatives responsible for the perceived threat of migrantized people here in Germany, because it's a perceived threat. Of course, we know from the studies being done that there is no increased risk of violence for these people in comparison to like German-born citizens or whatever.
And of course, the anger in the working class is growing. Have the AfD used that anger to build their party?
I would say so, yes, because they are finding a scapegoat for all these interconnected problems in the migrants, right? Because the migrants are taking your jobs, the migrants are taking the cheap apartments, because they are only leeching off the government money. I'm paraphrasing what AfD would say, and for some reason it works to kind of spew this rhetoric. AfD was also extremely successful in using social media to advance their rhetoric. So they very early on knew how to use apps like TikTok to kind of get this out to the younger generation.
And are you surprised about Musk's role in Germany? And what is Musk's role in Germany? He went there, apparently he was on a video stream to the AfD conference, greeting them and saying, forget about your past. You can't be responsible for the past.
Yeah, Musk's role in Germany is very strange. So the first interaction he had kind of with the German government, I think, was when he tried to build his Tesla plant in Grünheide near Berlin. And he quickly realized that we have relatively good worker protections, and he did not really like that. Also, he knew that his plant would need more water than he was allocated. And so now actually the inhabitants of that area are facing water shortages because of that Tesla plant. So he has a huge environmental impact on the people there too. But to come back to your original question, in this election cycle, he kind of cozied up to AfD, or rather they to him, or whatever. They have been spotted at Trump events in the US as well. So I guess it's mutual. And there was this event that you mentioned, which was live streamed to Twitter, I believe. And he seems to be trying to influence multiple governments all over the world. And it's to me, I mean, he's probably motivated by his own money on the one hand, like to advance his own cause and like undermine worker protections so that he will make even more money.
And the workers in the Berlin Tesla plant have been fighting for a union, and he's tried to prevent unionization in that Tesla plant. And also the Conservative Party now, who got the largest vote, they want to take away worker protections and are attacking the labor movement. And of course, Musk loves that deregulation, getting rid of any protections and regulations. The rise of this fascist movement in both the United States, Germany, around the world, is that seen as a threat by the left and the fight against fascism in Germany? And I understand there have been big demonstrations, which you participated in, against fascism. Why don't you talk about that counter movement to the AfD and the rise of fascism in Germany?
I mentioned the ex-chancellor making those remarks about we have to deport at a mass scale. After that, and after the AfD was revealed to have held multiple meetings with the express purpose of making a plan for mass deportations, there was an initial movement of demonstrations all over Germany against the right, very petty bourgeois, you could say, so without real impact. But it kind of made people aware that, oh, we might have to do something. However, that did not translate into actual organization, really. Then in June, AfD had their big Bundesparteitag, so their federal convention. And there was a coalition movement, Widersetzen, so resist, that mobilized against this federal convention and tried to organize mass civil disobedience to delay or even... They only delayed it, so they were not able to completely prevent it from happening, but they only delayed it. So that was that federal convention. And after that, it seemed to be a little bit quiet, and nobody expected for the elections to come so soon, because the Economic Liberal Party, the Free Democratic Party, they blew up the government coalition in the fall, and then everybody scrambled to nominate a new chancellor candidate and to go through the motions to be able to have an election, which now took place. And therefore, there was a second federal convention of the AfD within like 7 months. And the same coalition that mobilized against the first one mobilized against this one as well. And I think this time they try to make sure to establish better networks, so that in the different cities that where these coalition meetings started happening, they would be able to like get into a mode of organizing together better and to retain those structures. So we will see what comes from that.
Let's talk about DLINK. This was a left party that set up, and they did grow in this recent election. What has been going on with DLINK? It formed when Germany united, the sections of the German working class joined, ex-communists joined with Die Linke, formed this party. How did it take place? What has been its role? And there was recently a split in it with a leader leaving and running independently. What's been Die Linke's role in this whole struggle? Because they have also held positions in Germany and in Berlin, and have been in a coalition with the Greens.
Yeah, so Die Linke was kind of formed from, as you say, former members from Eastern Germany, as well as like more left-leaning social democrats who were not content with the Social Democratic Party. And it was started in the early 2000s. And so everybody was extremely surprised when suddenly the polls showed an increase of almost double of what was predicted before for Die Linke. And I think you can put that down to Heidi Reicheneck mostly, so their candidate for chancellor, because she started gaining traction for actually sticking to a social program, as left parties should do, right? And she understood how to kind of use social media as well. And I heard something this morning, which I think was relatively smart, from a researcher that was interviewed about the elections. She said that she believes that the social media race was so important this time because we had a winter election, and usually the candidates can go out into public events and like into the streets and canvassing and whatnot. And this was not really possible for, one, the short period, and two, the cold of the winter, so you don't meet that many people. And so the social media campaign was much more advantageous this time for the party like the Linke. And so I think previously this was mainly AfD territory, and she was smart enough to use that to her advantage as well.
Why don't you talk about the kind of repression against supporters of Palestine in Germany? I know in the United States, Trump has threatened to arrest Palestinian Americans, deport them. They say that in the United States, that if you're critical of Israel, you're an anti-Semite.
Same in Germany. So the federal parliament actually passed a resolution last year, I believe. And resolutions are non-binding. Parliamentary resolutions, they are not laws. But they basically said everybody critical of Israel is anti-Semitic. And therefore, we call for more strict, like to use the rules more strictly against them, because we have a responsibility as the German state that perpetrated the Holocaust. Yeah. And so this resolution was, and other left people, pro-Palestinian left people, have been warning against exactly that happening. It has been kind of used to justify repression against Palestine solidarity movements and also against other movements. We have seen with the protests against AfD that the police has become very brutal, and they have used violence and tear gas against protesters, even against groups with children in them, who really were not there to block anything, who were not part of the civil disobedience, but just part of the protest. And that is a result of police brutality being okay against Palestinian groups, right?
We have including Jewish
Including Jewish protesters, because of course we also have a Jewish voice for peace here in Germany, right? And they've been in this protest from the beginning. And yeah, maybe one example, when I went to one of the protests in Frankfurt, one of the Jewish comrades had a sign, "Another Jew against the genocide," I think it said. And the police took his sign away because they said, "No, no, no, you might be attacked if you say about yourself that you're a Jew."
That was Ellie Koch, German-American researcher and former member of the United Auto Workers, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Nina, 99 Red Balloons, in 1984 classic. This is Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm Polina Vasilyev. Gabriel Prawl, the former president of Seattle's ILWU Local 52, serves on the union's Juneteenth committee. He spoke with Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer at the Workers' Strike Back Conference in Seattle.
Yes. My name is Gabriel Prawl. I'm the past president of ILWU Local 52, chair of the Juneteenth Committee in at the waterfront in Seattle, and also president of the Seattle chapter of the A. Philip Randolph Institute, and coast-wide co-chair of the African American Longshore Coalition.
So there's been a long struggle here against racism in the labor movement and to build solidarity. And what's the lessons of some of your struggles, and what kind of struggles have you been in, both in the ILWU and the labor movement as a whole?
So, just to be clear, the labor movement, the largest labor organization in the United States, doesn't have anything to fight against racism within the union. There's nothing on the book that says you're going to be penalized for being racist or you're not going to be allowed into the union. That's a fact. That's why it's so easy for union leaders to just ignore the fact that there's racism going on in their local or in their union. And then looking at the climate that's going on in the world outside of the union, we can see clearly all fascist, racist, and bigotry, and all these things are materializing in the nation, and which is causing a lot of hurt. And the fact that the dismantling of DEI by the new administration in there right now, that tells us what we have in front of us. They're trying to take us back, let's put it this way. And we have to stand up and fight back. There's got to be a movement.
And some of these politicians, Trump and others, they want to go back to the good old days in the United States. I mean, where they think that the good old days were better for people. What is the reality of the good old days?
You know what? The good old days, I don't know when the hell it was a good old days. But I'll tell you the truth, because we're the lowest in when it comes to education. We're in the lowest when it comes to health care. We're in the lowest when it comes to taking care of our people in this country. We're in the lowest when it comes to taking care of our children in this country as far as resources. I mean, let's talk about homelessness. It's ridiculous. So when they say make America great again, I don't know what the hell he's talking about, because America was never great. It was depressed. It's always been depressing. It's always been oppressed to people, and it's always invest into creating oppression abroad. So I'm still waiting for that day.
And The labor movement, as you said, there's been no campaign when there were hanging nooses put up around the country. There was no national education campaign. Is there and should there be a real political education campaign about racism, what it is and how to fight it in the labor movement?
And you're right about that, Steve. You know, if we go back in the early 1900s when the labor movement was really doing what the labor movement was in really moving in the direction that workers should be moving, we had a whole different labor movement than what we have today. The militancy that the labor movement had made a whole lot of change for us. I know today you got this administration trying to take that all away from us. And we cannot step back and let that happen. But the reality is that labor is standing by quiet. The Democratic Party is standing by quiet. And you got this administration that violating every rule, doing every illegal stuff, and expect to continue to do it without any accountability. And the people of this country is tired. They're not going to take it. They're not going to allow it to happen. And one of the big things that happened to us in this time is that the crazy thing that this administration is doing as awakening the sleeping giants at the labor movement. And I think that that's what it's going to take to wake everybody else up, because we are now seeing that everybody that thought that they weren't going to be affected by the changes that this administration is doing now is seeing that he lied and they was wrong and they are feeling it now.
That was Gabriel Prawl, former president of Seattle's ILWU Local 52, speaking to Pacifica's Steve Zeltzer. That was Gigi, Adwa. You're listening to Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. I'm your host, Paulina Vasiliev. André Bluin was a Congolese political activist, anti-colonial leader, and women's rights advocate. Born in 1921 in what is now the Central African Republic to a French father and an African mother, she was raised in a Catholic orphanage where she was denied connection to her African heritage. Bluin became a prominent figure in the fight against colonialism, particularly in the Democratic Republic of Congo, where she was a close advisor to Congolese Prime Minister Patrice Lumumba. As the director of the women's wing of his party, she mobilized grassroots support and was one of the few women involved at high levels in African liberation politics. Following Lumumba's assassination in 1961, Bluin was forced into exile, but she continued her advocacy for decolonization and women's rights internationally. She later wrote her autobiography, My Country, Africa, the autobiography of the Black Passionaria, detailing her experiences in the independence struggles. André Bluin's daughter, writer and documentarian Yves Bluin, spoke to Block Report's J.R. Valray.
Well, your mom was a leading figure in the Pan-African movement. Can you talk a little bit about her upbringing, as she talks about in her new book, My Country, Africa? Can you talk about her upbringing and what led her to getting involved in the freedom fight?
Well, she was born in 1921. And 1921 in Africa, I mean, she was born literally in the country of the heart of darkness of Conrad, you know. So it's exactly where she was born, which is the Republic of Central Africa, as we call it today. But back then it was called Ubangi-Shari. So she was born in 1921. Her mother was a tribes girl. She was 14 years old, and her father was a merchant, a French guy, and they had my mother. So as it was extremely remote, people have to understand that in 1921 Africa, there was literally nothing. It's not the way Africa looks today. You would have those cities, for example, Brazzaville or Bangui, which is the capital of Ubangi. It was like literally a few houses, not even an hospital, but it was like an infirmary, a post office, and a few shops. That was it. And surrounded by the jungle and the immensity of Africa, which is so huge that people don't even realize that you can put China, America, Europe, India, etc., etc., in this country.
Mm. So I know that the death of your brother led to your mother's politicization. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that led her into that African movement?
Well, she then grew up in this place that was like an orphanage, an institution for mixed race children, because they did not exist back then, you see. And therefore, she pursued her life being, you know, a seamstress. And then she had my sister from out of wedlock. Then she the guy disappeared, and then she married this man, and she had a son with him, and the child fell very sick. The local administrator who didn't want her to have the quinine, you know, the medicine for her son, because he was a quarter black, and he died. So that was the catalyst of her anger and revolt that she felt because of that. And of course, a lot of people are asking, but was it legal? Was it normal? No, it was not legal at all.
What was not legal?
The fact of not allowing a child to have this treatment.
And where was this?
This was in Ubangi. But it was, you see, it's hard to understand. Those guys, they would have complete power. They would do everything they wanted, even though it was against the law, you see. So this man was probably an extremely rabid racist, and therefore refused the treatment for my little brother. And my mother, of course, she was so devastated that it created in her this anger that led to her political definition and option.
So how did it move from there to from this grief and this pain and this devastation to her working directly with the leading?
It took a few years, you see. She was like brewing at the time. And then she met my father, who was also a Frenchman. But my dad was extremely humanist, had no idea about the colonies. He arrived from France. He was working there. It was a different, completely different background for him. There was no such thing as racism in his bones ever. So then they got married, and they moved to Guinea. And Guinea at the time, compared to Ubangi, which was the Central Africa, in Guinea, it was very politicized. The decolonization process was on its way. So people were very conscious about getting away from France. And that's when my mother got involved. And that's when she met Sékou Touré. And that's when my parents met Kwame Nkrumah. And that's when the whole thing started, really. It was...
Well, what was her position in her relationship with Sékou Touré? Because I believe she worked for his government, right?
My mother was an activist. My mother was, she was on the ground. That's where she excelled. She was very good at organizing rallies, talking to people, and put a crowd in trance with her speech. And she really was talented on that. And that's what Sékou Touré asked her to do. She was working for the RDA, which was his movement. And she was rallying and touring Guinea and making the people vote against France, against the rule of France. And that's how she started. And then, of course, Sékou Touré introduced her to all her friends. You know, they were a group of people with, including Nkrumah, who was his best friend. And Touré really gave her the tools to begin her political career.
When you say he gave her the tools, you mean the political connections or are you saying the political knowledge or what do you mean?
Knowledge she already had because actually, funny enough, let's say that she was trained by my dad, who was very liberal, you see, and he acquainted her with all these books at the time that when you do activism, you want to read, you see. So that was one thing. But Touré, on the other hand, introduced her to the people who were doing their job in terms of decolonization at the time.
So did she go country to country or was she just stationed in Guinea with Sékou Touré when she worked with Nkrumah and Lumumba?
Well, what happened is that she started in Guinea. Then Guinea became independent. So while she was in Guinea, one day they went to a restaurant. You see, life is funny sometimes, you see, just... when things are aligned, they are aligned. So it was definitely meant to happen. She goes to the restaurant with my dad, and she hears a group of guys next to them talking Lingala, which is the language of Congo and Central Africa. So nobody talks that language at all in Guinea, you see. So she hears them talking that language, so she was very curious, and she goes to see them, and she says, well, I'm sorry, I just heard you talking Lingala. Are you from Congo? And they say yes. So then they start talking, and then she realizes that they were the activists from the Congo that, that came to Guinea, invited by Sékou Touré to train and get together in order to carry on the independence in the Congo. So then they asked her, because they knew of her talent at rallying people and all that, they asked her if she could come and help in the Congo, because, you know, they needed help. So then Touré said, he interfered. He said, you know, they talked to him and they said, you think we can borrow André and ask her to come and help with the rallies in the Congo? And he said, absolutely, she will help you and she's going to organize your activism over there. And that's how she went to the Congo. And that's how she started this extraordinary job that she did over there, rallying. I mean, she rallied 45,000 women, and women had absolutely no rights. I mean, they were like even more than second-class citizens, you see. So it was extraordinary. I mean, what she did in the Congo was extraordinary. And then she met Lumumba, you know. She was working with the Gizenga. She was working for the PSA at the time, which is the Parti Solidaire Africain, with Gizenga. And she was like the big sister of the, all these guys, because they were young, you know. All these they were like 30 years old and she was already 40. So she was like a big sister. She had a sort of ascendant on them. So they had to obey, if you see what I mean. She was, you know, she was quite formidable, and she had this natural authority about her that made her people would listen to her. So then she met Lumumba,
Patrice Lumumba, right?
Patrice Lumumba, yeah. And he named her his chief of protocol. And so she was in charge of, you know, the organization and everything. So then she rallied everybody for him, you see. So he won the elections and he was named the prime minister. So what she did was actually unbelievable, particularly for women back in those days, you know. But she was indispensable to all these movements because of her capacity to rally people and particularly to rally women to the cause, you see. So
what kind of issues did she deal with organizing women?
Well, the problem was, for example, it's a funny thing, you see, it's very sad, because the women were, I mean, they were so completely, I mean, they were treated like slaves, literally. They had no rights. They were owned by their family, who could marry them in exchange of money. And they couldn't say anything. They had no rights whatsoever. And on top of that, there was a big problem of alcoholism and prostitution, because to make ends meet, they had to do something. And, you know, it was hard. It was really hard. So she managed to make, you know, the self-esteem of these girls were so low that when they threw themselves into the decolonization and the revolution, there was a huge breath of fresh air for them. And that's where exactly out of these weaknesses, she made something colossal. So these women became the most revolutionary, even more than guys, you see, because of all the possibilities that the revolution would give them.
So what was you guys' life like when first Kwame Nkrumah got overthrown and then he was installed as a co-president in Guinea? How was that? And were you guys there when that was happening?
No, we were not there. We were not there because what happened is that when Lumumba was killed, they put, how do you call that? You know, when you have to, a bounty, they put a bounty on Mother. So she had to disappear. And they put my dad and my brother in jail, and me and my grandmother, Mami's mother, who was this Central African woman, in a jail somewhere with Mobutu's soldiers. You know, I mean, it was dramatic. It was really bad. So then we've managed to regroup with the help of some activist friends. Our family managed to regroup after that. We went to Switzerland. We went back to Europe. We couldn't stay in Africa anymore because we literally were persona non grata. So we went to Switzerland and we stayed there because the son of le General Guisan, who is the only general that Switzerland ever had, believe it or not, was a big fan of Lumumba. So he gave us a flat where we could stay, and we stayed there with his help because we had no money, we had absolutely nothing. So we stayed in Switzerland because we couldn't go back to France because of political views, obviously. And the only place that allowed us to stay was Switzerland. And then my dad found a job in Paris, and eventually he was going back and forth between Switzerland and Paris. And then after that, we left Switzerland and we went to Algiers. That was the Mecca of all the revolutionaries at the time, you know. And that was in 1964. We arrived in Algiers, we took the boat from Marseille. And we arrived in Algiers. Algeria was freshly independent. And then the government took us in. They gave a job to my father, and my mother continued her activism from there.
When you guys were in exile, your mother was still doing activism, or did she have to just lay low?
She never stopped, no. And for example, the life in Algeria was very fertile in terms of politics and activism, because the whole, Algeria at the time was really the Mecca of all the revolutionaries, all of them. I mean, they would allow those guys to come and stay, they would pay for the apartments, they would give them money. It was extraordinary what this country has done for Africa and for the militants at the time. You had like Amilcar Cabral. I mean, even the Black Panther were there, you know? And so of course, when you have this kind of cauldron bubbling with all these ideas and aims for Pan-Africanism and the unity of Africa, so yes, it was very productive and very active.
You're listening to the voice of Yves Blouin speaking to J.R. Valray here on Pacifica's Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. Yves' mother, Andrée Blouin, once called the most dangerous woman in Africa, played a leading role in the struggles for decolonization that shook the continent in the 1950s and 60s, advising the post-colonial leaders of Algeria, both Congos, Ivory Coast, Mali, Guinea, and Ghana. Her autobiography is titled My Country, Africa, Autobiography of the Black Passionaria. Now back to J.R. Valray in conversation with Andrée Blouin's daughter, writer and documentarian Yves Blouin.
So what was it like when a lot of the leaders start getting assassinated, dying, all of the original leaders of the Pan-African Revolution, Nassar, Bembella, when all of them started falling off? What was you guys' life like?
Well, you know, it was very banal. We had a family life. She was a mother. She was a housewife. And there was no, microwave oven or any, I mean, it was very basic at the time, you know. But she was always very active in writings and organizing these things, you see, these reunions and conclaves and all that. She was, she would hear from the newspaper what was going on. And of course, at home, our flat in Algiers was like, I mean, it was full of people. There were reunions every day. It was like the Pan-African Chamber for a Better World. So there were always some guys coming, and they would talk endlessly of changing the world, changing Africa, and the unity of Africa. My brother and I, we were doing our homework with this in the background, and the kitchen was busy because there was always some food for those guys. And she was very African. There was always somebody coming and going, and always a stew with rice and beer, and that's the way it was happening, really. And then you would have the lots of reunions organized by the government, the Algerian government, and of course the parties at the African embassies of Algiers. So that was the big event, because there was nothing else to do. So they would meet there and talk endlessly about changing the world. It was fantastic. The 70s in Africa, it was unbelievable. Everything was, I mean, they were like fresh, full of determination and hopes, and everything was possible. It was fantastic.
So how did your mom start to document her life? Was this something that she did towards the end of her life, or was she keeping papers all the way, or how?
She started when we were in Switzerland, and then something happened there. So she had all these, all these files, all these documents, and she already had started drafting the story of her life. And then one day, she was approached by some journalists from Italy, and they said that they wanted to write an article about her. And basically, they said, look, if you have a script, a manuscript, we can help you with this. And she was, I mean, even though she was revolutionary and everything, and she was quite, she was very wise, on the other hand, she was extremely naive, because she would trust anyone. So she gave them her manuscript, they tweaked it and published it. And then somebody told her, but your book is out. And she could not believe it. They did it without her consent. And the book was called Mi chiamavano la passionaria nera, meaning they called me the black passionaria. That was the title of the book. So she sued them, and she won, and the book was destroyed. So that was first story. Then,
what year was that?
That was in 1963, just after the death of Patrice Lumumba. And it was after the death of Patrice. So then after that, she continued amassing some notes and writings, and she was doing all other stuff as well. She was writing articles for the El Mujahideen, which is the newspaper of the revolution in Algiers. And she was very active, and she kept on writing speeches. That was her forte. She was very good at that, for diplomats, for revolutionaries who needed a speech for tonight's reunion, or a rally in the stadium, Mohammed number 5, or that's the way it was happening, her writing. And then she went to New York. We went together with my brother and my mother and I, and there she met Rosa Guy, a writer in New York, who was French. She was a Michaud bookshop in Harlem. So Rosa Guy, she was this black American writer, and she introduced her to her friends, who were in the publishing business. And they signed a contract. They wanted to publish her. But then she met somebody who was introduced to her by a guy from Angola. And it was his girlfriend, I think. And they became friends, and she said, look, I can write, I can publish your book, I can do something about it. And then she decided to go with her and this person. I don't know what happened, you know, they she you know, people always try to get something out of a situation. So then the second book was published in 1983, My Country Africa. And then my mother died. Then this woman died a few years later, and the book was not published anymore. So it took me decades to be able to recoup the rights of this book, because it just disappeared. I had no idea how to get it and how to get the rights back legally, you know, to do the right thing. And finally, I was able to do so. And now the book is published again. It took me all this time.
So with the book's name is My Country, Africa, Memoirs of a Black Passionaria, right?
That's right, yeah.
What does that mean? What is a Black Passionaria?
La Passionaria is, it's a Spanish word. It means a woman of passion, like passion, you know, passionaria. And in fact, it was coined, the word passionaria was coined by an anarchist activist female. I think it was in the 20s, or yeah, maybe between 1910 and 1920. I can't tell you exactly the dates. But this woman was called Dolores Ibaruri. And Dolores Ibaruri, she was like, she was enormous. She was in the milieu, in the Spanish politics. She was the queen, the empress of the anarchist movement at the time. And when she would go on stage and talk to people, you could hear a fly. She would just suck the attention and the souls of the people listening to her. So mommy was like that. My mother was very, she really had a talent. She knew how to speak to people on stage. And that's why they called her the Black Passionaria, because she was just like Dolores Ibaruri, the anarchist. They had the same kind of talent. And that's how her name, why she was called the Passionaria as well.
Was your mother, I mean, I've studied a lot about the Pan-African revolutions of the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and there's not a lot of women that went between the countries that we know about. Is her story an extraordinary story? And is she one of very few? And I want to know that, or is it just that they're not being documented like that?
I think it's a bit of both. It's very difficult to find documentation about these times, you know, particularly in Africa. And also, there were no women at all, almost, in the world of politics in Africa. It was a male thing, you know, a woman. Oh, no. She had no room, no place in this arena. But mother was one of the few who managed to do so.
That was writer and documentarian Yves Blouin speaking about her mother, André Blouin. Blouin's autobiography, My Country, Africa, Autobiography of the Black Passionaria, is out now from Verso Books. We'll be airing the rest of J.R. Valray's conversation with Yves Blouin on March 8th as part of International Women's Day programming on WPFW, Pacifica Radio in Washington, D.C. You can find more from JR at blockreportradioworld.com. And that concludes today's edition of Capitalism, Race, and Democracy. We thank all of Pacifica's sister stations and affiliates who contribute to the production of this show. Today's program was produced by the Capitalism, Race, and Democracy Collective, with contributions from Steve Zeltzer and JR Valray. You can find this and all previous episodes at our website, capitalismraceanddemocracy.org. Make sure you click the subscribe button. Follow us on X, formerly Twitter, at Pacifica CRD. I've been your host, Paulina Vasiliev. Thanks for listening.